I'm starting, and I'm hoping there will be time to hear what Eric has to say as well. I'm gonna talk about this paper from a couple years ago. Which was a 9904.3922 with. So I'm going to talk about this paper where we attempted to construct some observables that look behind the horizons of at least certain black holes, with some hope that that would generalize. I might at the end also talk about Eva Gary and I, together with Steve Schenker, spent the next year trying to go farther. We don't have a coherent story, but there are a couple things I might try to mention at the end. The original paper had a large number of moving parts and some confused ways of saying things, which I think I can say simpler. My attempts to cover them all in one talk usually lead to disaster. And so mindful of this lesson that the first two-thirds of any planned talk expands to fill the available time, I've cut it down a little bit. We'll see how good that does. Okay, so the basic point is in some ways very simple, in that we studied the D-brain dynamics in ADS and sort of sliced it up a little bit and orbifolded it, and thereby constructed a known black hole and some observables which see inside the horizon. And in the version we did, this all pulls back from the Poincaré dynamics, so I think we have some confidence that we're talking about a nice probe of behind the horizon physics. So first let me just talk about start by talking about the just the process of in space-time of going from the Poincaré slicing of ADS to these hyperbolic black holes. Okay, so I'll start with the Poincaré slicing T squared. This is the Poincaré slicing of ADS. As I've written it down, it can be discussed in any number of dimensions, but I'll focus on ADS5 for the purposes of this talk. So this is a three-dimensional slice. This is the, of course, the Penrose diagram of this Minkowski, the boundary, the metric is conformal at the boundary to Minkowski space, of which this is the Penrose diagram. And then here is sort of a cartoon of the Poincaré slice of ADS. ADS here and this piece here unwraps to this. So I'm just going to write a piece of this. I can write, of course, the Milne slicing going to minus dt. This is the metric on hyperbolic 3 space, and if I look at the Penrose diagram of Minkowski space, depending on the sine of tp, this covers this slice here, where this is tp. These slices here are constant tp, and this boundary is tp goes to 0 minus. Of course, I could always construct another Milne slicing from the future where tp goes to 0 from the positive direction here. This is just a slicing of Minkowski space, and I can take this metric, which is just Minkowski space, some slicing in Minkowski space, and stick it in to this bracketed region here. And I get ds squared is rp squared over l squared minus tp squared plus d sigma squared drp squared over rp squared. And if I look here, I'm just going to slice the cylinder in half. If I look at the cylinder here, the Poincaré covers this part, and this will cover this shaded region here. Okay, so far nothing particularly shocking. So far this is just a rewriting of ADS. This dotted line at TP goes to 0 minus so far is a fake singularity, because the full thing is just ADS. I can orbifold H3 to H3 mod gamma by choosing some appropriate, and if I choose an appropriate discrete subgroup of the isometries of H3, I can do an orbifolding which is fixed point 3 and which gives me a finite volume. And in this case, then, it's the lower, it's this piece, which I'm covering by these coordinates. Oh, I'm sorry. It's actually a little bit complicated. This is what the boundary actually looks like. If I go out to the boundary, I'm describing this piece here. But if you actually look at how the slices continue into the interior closely, you'll find that it covers that whole lower half.
Even though that reaches spatial infinity?
Yeah. It's how the slices actually look as you go into the interior. That's right.
It's not the entire lower half. It's the inside of the light cone. At every R equals constant slice,
right,
it covers the Kazan space. And this is covering the interior of the light cone of the origin.
You know, you get, I know, I the you get the whole interior of this region. Yeah, that's right. That's what I was saying.
Because what Gary said, it's just not
worked. Right. That's right. The Minkowski slices are still doing this. The constant R slices are still doing that. So, yeah, that's right. They're not. This is the boundary and this is the bulk. This is a projection onto the boundary. This is the bulk slicing. Two different views. Yes. Yes, which continues. As I go into the bulk, it's always here. I take these diamonds and I look at the diamond on each of these slicings here.
It's the vertex.
It's the vertex. Yeah.
The dotted line is just the vertex of that.
Yes. Light cone at every value of r. Yes. It's a different projection. This is a projection on the boundary. This is the continuous. So this would describe the slice out on the boundary. These are, when I look at this coordinate system for all values of r, it fills out this region. Okay. We're good? Right. That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes. Okay, so if I do this orbifolding, this coordinate singularity becomes an honest-to-God singularity in the sense that the volume of this is going to zero here. And so it becomes an actual singularity. And when we had, in this case, as RP goes to infinity, the metric is conformal to the Milne slicing, which we refer to as the collapsing cone, for lack of a better word, and we look for lots of words. So where the base of this cone is understood to be this sigma or hyperbolic space, depending on what you want to do. Okay, so it turns out that this, so when we first constructed this, we were thinking of this as some version of sort of ADS, some version of the various Big Bang singularities in ADS that people were studying, but it was then pointed out to us that this space-time is in fact the space-time of a black hole with a horizon whose volume is the volume of this in ADS units. So if I let RL T over L over, here I forgot to say, it should be obvious, curly L is just the ADS for ADS. So if I do this coordinate transformation, I get the following metric, like so, which looks, which is singular. The coordinate transformation is singular at r equals L, and I get a metric which looks an awful lot like the metric of a black hole, and in fact is. It's a black hole with a hyperbolic horizon. This here corresponds to r equals L, and is the horizon, and then therefore this is the interior of the black hole. Okay. So the note that R equals L corresponds to RP TP is equal to L squared, and it's a totally regular point, of course, in the it's just the horizon, it's a totally regular point, regular region, for example, from the point of view of the original Poincaré coordinates. And also notice that as R goes to infinity, the metric is conformal to R cross sigma, which is, if you like, a sort of cylinder with this compact hyperbolic base. Okay, so those are the two things that we were studying. And the game, of course, is to, the point is going to be that I can write down certain certain observables which seem to have which should have some fairly somewhat natural gauge theory description, and in this case we can design observables, the dynamics of these observables which might describe the positions of d-brains pull back naturally from Poincaré, and therefore should describe what's going on inside the horizon. Yes. Right. Yes, that's
your choice of what kind of thing to decide inside is a better case, but
precisely. Yes. Yes, that's one.
What does it exactly mean to mod out gamma on the
boundary? What does it mean to mod out? I'm looking at conformal field theory on this compact space. I can do that.
You're assuming that the duality commutes
with the orbital folding. Yes.
Which doesn't always happen.
Why not?
Well, because if you had created, like, let's say you had created an orbital singularity at the bulk, then you might have Gaussian compensation. I mean, there might be some different ground state for the bulk than just the orbifold of the original bulk. Now, I'm not saying I have a theory, but...
But it's possible.
There are cases where that does happen.
Right.
As far as I understand, it's reflected by instability of the boundary.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah. Yeah, and there's an instability in this theory, for example, because the hyperboloid is negatively curved. So the scalars have a tachyonic potential, and that's reflected in bulk dynamics, in fact. Yeah. But that exact those singularities end up showing up in the boundary and in the bulk. And there's sort of a map between those instabilities typically. I think I'm pretty yes, I don't see why if we just want to describe the pass cone, we need to do more than this bit here.
Yeah.
Right. Yes, that's...
You have the same separation in the bulk.
Yes.
Well, presumably it does. I mean, there is a duality still. So
right.
Presumably it does in some sense or not. But it's just the ground state of the bulk is no longer the orbifold, the naive orbifold of
sure.
the original bulk.
But I think there's a map. I mean, as in this case, and that actually shows up in this case. I mean, the potential on the boundary, because you know, I'm going to say I have n equals 4 super Yang mills on this space, and this is a compact negatively curved slice. So there's an instability due to the coupling of the scalars to negative curvature. The instability would roughly correspond in the scalar field sector, and that does indeed correspond to the fact that d-brains in the bulk will want to run off to infinity. Yeah, you have to have the brains in, certainly. Yes, you can. Yeah. So it's the one where you nucleate brains outside the horizon, an instanton-like solution where you nucleate brains outside the horizon and then continue up to infinity. Thank you. There's a I haven't gotten to the gauge theory interpretation yet, but I'll yes.
I think you're on the same page.
Uh-huh.
I think you agree that in this case, taking the quotient doesn't exactly communicate because there is resemblance. So while I think those
well, you've taken the quotient in the bulk and the boundary, and then the you've introduced the instability in the bulk and the boundary, so I don't know what you mean. There's a descent, the duality descends down. The instability is not present in the...
It is.
Yeah. Then there's a difference between that if you put the conformal field around the negative space, just the conformal field theory, but
right.
it has a minus 5 potential for
right.
the boundary side.
It's also present in the bulk side. Once I've done the orbifolding, it's present in the bulk side as well. So I'd say everything...
I think we all agree with the statement that the Poincaré patch is
yes.
from a certain region of the bulk.
Right.
And therefore, there's something this part of the field theory would still describe the central region.
Right.
Is there at least a small leap in making the same statement after you've taken the quotient when it is completely obvious that after you've taken the quotient?
So, this is a general thing that happens with all these relationships. My point of view on that is. One system with two different descriptions, if you can do something to it,
you
can do that thing to
yes.
the other description
in
one
and
the same physical system.
Right. The orbifolding is just acting on the spatial directions, and there's a map between those and Balkan boundaries. Yeah.
I'm happy to share. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to sort out the technicalities and whether, in principle, there is room for a discussion of what exactly is the same physical system in the bulk. Do we need to keep the entire piece of it?
And also,
what's the value of the gamma?
looks. I'm not sure if my co-authors are going to agree with this, but
okay.
I think about it very naively, but the rolling down and the branding which sort of rolls off to infinity in this sort of quote unstable static cylinder patch maps into the Poincaré patch to something which stays a constant radius in the Poincaré coordinates. So
yes.
You get the same dynamics, you just don't call it an instability in the Poincaré description.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, so it's the same thing. It's not like it's a change.
Yeah, everything we've done, yeah.
The ratio of the eigenvalue,
right. To the point where you are, if as you're evolving on this cone, there's a ratio of the W mass to the volume of the base at any given time, and that's constant. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Can you talk? And then you talk. No, there's a singularity at the tail. At t equals zero, it's not a singularity. Yes. Yes. There are absolutely compact orbifolds which give you smooth orbifolds which get nowhere. It acts freely on the hyperboloid. Yes.
Where is the singularity in that diagram?
Alex next, and then him.
One point is that it only acts on freely on the hyperboloid minus one once. So if you wanted to be really nitpicky, you would certainly worry that there are, like, so for example, there are regions of the boundary.
No.
No, it's not on the boundary of the hyperboloid. There are fixed points on the boundary of the hyperboloid. There are points on the boundary of anti-de-Sitter space which are fixed points under this rule.
That's true. No, you can magnify the hyperbole.
In order to magnify the hyperboloid, you need to throw out the limit points of the group action on the boundary. But the boundary of the hyperboloid is part of the boundary of anti-de-Sitter space. So there are points on the boundary of anti-de-Sitter space.
There's a free action on, we have a work product.
But those isometries have fixed points on the boundary of the
hyperbole.
Yeah,
that's true.
Why
do you care? The reason, yes, I mean, I'm the devil's advocate for a second. And then pointing out that the boundary of the hyperbole also is part of the boundary of anti-de-Sitter. But this gets back to what people were saying about the Poincaré, about any Poincaré duality. If you believe the Poincaré duality, then you don't have to worry about those points. They're not part of the state.
Right.
They're sort of at the boundary.
Well,
they're gone. They're at the boundaries.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to remind you this discussion. If you, normally, if you have two points, you have fixed points, you produce, zero size curves. Like,
that's
not true.
I mean, it's just true that there are limit points at the boundary of the hyperbole. That's just what you're saying.
Yes, with the boundary included.
Right.
When we do our quotient, we get, domains which repeat infinitely often.
Yes.
That's because
you've compactified already in saying that. These points aren't getting arbitrarily close in physical distance. Yes, it's not relevant. Right. They're not,
If you were worried, if you were going to worry that the duality didn't hold in this case, it would probably be because of things like that.
Yeah, I don't see that.
For example, if you were to consider the action of this orbifold on global anti-de-Sitter space, there are parts of the boundary of global anti-de-Sitter space where this orbifold acts ergodically. And so,
it's one fixed point that Alex is talking about, which is inside the Poincaré patch, and it's actually at the vertex of the light.
Yeah. Because right at the boundary of the Poincaré patch.
You
mean here? Right. Right. Yeah, t equals zero, the thing is singular. I'm certainly, what? T equals zero is the dotted line. The horizontal dotted line. That's the singularity. I have no idea what goes on there.
Well, all along the light. But this question, how evenly do you say the quotient acts on both sides of the system? If you create the quotient of the entire local agency, you have to do that.
No, I think we're not doing that.
Right, so is that
we're not doing that.
So there's a small leap to saying if you just take the quotient of a piece of the local agency, that it describes this part.
I think as long as the duality held before I...
The locality or
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no one's debating, I mean, I think it's all right. Like a natural conclusion to everyone who's been speaking, that it's right. A question of is there room for... Is that an assumption? Is that an assumption?
Well, right, but this point about locality is underlying.
Yes.
I think if you accept that...
That's out the window.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a question. How much locality is it?
I mean, it might also help to review. There are other orbitals in the area sphere.
Right.
And in those cases, you know, there's some cases where it leads back to a stable sphere, other cases where it doesn't, but it seems to light up on the sides when it is.
Those are easier because they're not space-time mixed all the way to CFU. Well,
this is probably done by space.
I think, didn't Paul have a question?
Do you understand that the boundary seems to be not stable?
Yeah, it's the R phi squared term. It's it's here. It's this. So the four curvature comes entirely from the. Now this is on the boundary, and I've done a conformal transformation, which the four curvature is not invariant. It's a conformal transformation takes me from the collapsing cone to this, and that introduces curvature. Yeah. Which formula?
The top left corner.
The top left corner and the the top left. No. That's just a diffeomorphism. Yeah. The four curvature of that metric is zero. It's going to this metric, which is just minus d t squared plus d sigma squared. This is curved.
There's a Weyl transformation.
There's a Weyl transformation to go from the collapsing from Minkowski to the collapsing cone. It's just a coordinate transformation. From the collapsing cone to this static cylinder, is a Weyl transformation, and that introduces curvature. This was just reslicing Poincaré, and by reslicing the boundary Minkowski, and I have it's just the Milne slicing of Minkowski space.
Did you take a quotient?
I take a quotient there. Yes. Yeah. The quotient introduces the instability. After I've taken the quotient and done the transformation, it introduces the instability. The instability in this framework, in the collapsing cone framework, looks just like this. Actually maps to some nice constant R trajectories and Poincaré.
So if you look at this distinction within the boundary of the field,
yeah, scattering problems. It's an instability where you go off to an infinity and infinite time. So it's not like the kinds of I think so.
There is no reasonable inference in this case. I mean, because the eigenvalue goes to infinity, the part is making it as much energy as you want into the W boson.
No, the W bosons become very heavy as the eigenvalue goes to infinity.
Right, but there's also an infinite amount of energy that you can find.
It's true that the spectrum is unbounded below, but I maintain that if I. But this is an infinite. If you want to, so if I do finite time processes, I get finite answers. What? And there's no ground state. It's unboundable.
That's why I'm asking whether if you really try and do not just the classical behavior of an eigenvalue.
No, I claim if I set up a nice wave packet in a finite distance and I do scattering of those sort of wave packets in field space, then I get finite answers. It's a more complicated quantum mechanics, but it's just quantum mechanics. I can do quantum mechanics of the inverted harmonic oscillator, too. It's a completely reasonable thing. This is just a more complicated version of that. Yeah, not qualitatively so, I think. Yeah. Right. It's a finite number of modes that go unstable.
Yeah.
Right. It's typically it's the zero mode and a few possible and a finite number of Klitzel-Klein modes that are typically unstable in this. Okay. So. The next thing I want to talk a bit about is the DBI dynamics of D3 brains in this space. The positions of these D3 brains should be coordinates on the Coulomb branch of your field theory, so they should correspond to good, reasonable field theory observables. So let me first talk about the what we call these, the interior coordinates. So first, I can start with the known DBI dynamics of a D3 brain moving, which fills out R4 and is moving in radius. And the DBI dynamics will be some DTP R cubed, that's a big DT, R cubed square root of RP squared over L squared, square root minus L squared over RP squared times DT RP squared. There's also a minus RP to the fourth. E to the fourth over L to the fourth. This last term just comes from the 4 form. And so these are the DBI, this is the DBI dynamics of D3 brains in Poincaré. It should describe some motion, again, out on so the dynamics of motion out on the Coulomb branch, where I have broken the gauge symmetry down. And so now the going from Poincaré to this slicing is just a coordinate transformation on the bulk and on the boundary. So I can rewrite this action just by doing the space-time coordinate transformation. And I'll find that this goes to S is equal to, I'll put some volume factor out here, d. T sub p, r sub p cubed, t sub b cubed over l cubed square root squared over l squared minus over r p squared d t p r p squared. That's a minus sign there, and minus r p to the fourth t p cubed over l. So I just did this coordinate transformation. These extra factors of TP cubed came from starting with the sort of four-dimensional description, starting with the description of the Coulomb branch dynamics in four dimensions, truncating to the zero modes. And that truncation introduces these factors of TP cubed, which are the volume of the collapsing base. Okay. Now, this is perfectly well defined for all TP less than zero. In particular, it's regular at TP RP is equal to L squared which is the location of the horizon. Nothing funny goes on here, so I have what looks like a perfectly sensible dynamics of some perfectly sensible gauge theory observable, which naturally probes physics behind the horizon. So just descended.
There's a step here that I always get confused about. Where is the gauge theory drawn? This was a statement in the bulk.
This was a statement in the bulk. So the statement is that the DBI dynamics of D3 brains, the location of the D brains, corresponds to a gauge theory observable.
Location of D brains as described by the Poincaré
coordinates. Mm-hmm. And I've just done a coordinate transformation of that so far.
It corresponds to a gauge theory observable,
which is? Which, a gauge theory observable, which... It's you can measure it, for example, by some mass scale, which is measures the distance from the origin of the Coulomb branch. Okay.
We're supposed to think about this coordinate of the brain and the Coulomb as some kind of, at least in some approximation, local field in the CFT. Is that correct?
It's a super selection sector. Right. I'm just looking.
So we're interested only in the zero, not in the...
We could study...
There's not a super selection sector. There's a local field in the field theory that tells you
how
free brain is wriggling in the pool.
There's also that, but in addition to the
Right.
In addition, there would be the astronomical values of that.
Right.
Before you point out for the local field, before you can identify the astronomical values of our super selection sector.
I would say that even if I was at right.
Okay. Great. But the idea is then that this effective local field at some T and X in the field theory tells me where the D3 brain is at the same T and X in Poincaré coordinates. Is that the idea? Is it a local map from the CFT to the bulk?
Is there some effectively 4D dynamics that would also tell me where if the D brain is rippling in the bulk, can I map the locally?
If you mean as a function of pi, if you have a ripple as a function of x, it's the same thing out there.
Right.
So the conclusion must be that there's an effectively local field in the CFT.
Yeah.
At least some local approximation, which tells you where the D3 brain is in the bulk, what value of R it's at.
Yes. I think I would want to say that, yeah.
But I don't see how it can possibly be true, because a local field at a point in the CFT doesn't know which point array patch it's part of. If you assign a different point array patch, you get different answers. So I'm confused about what the paradigm is here.
You could slide the Poincaré slice up and down. That's always true.
Which is right, that if you take some object, for example, if you put it near the horizon one point for the time, now we're at the top, so now it's really at high.
I would actually disagree also. I claim that
to make a map from a local object on the boundary to something we can
done. I claim that if I fix the location on the boundary and slide the where I'm drawing the Minkowski diamond to get a new Poincaré patch, the field theory in R4, I have changed the observable for the field theory in R4. That change could be non-trivial. Right. Yeah, I have changed the observable. That change could be non-trivial. I don't know what that change actually does to the observable. That change could be quite complicated.
Mm-hmm. And if there's a local, then you could imagine a local, if something is truly a local observable in the field theory, it's the same dev, has the same dev, if you like, no matter which Poincaré patch I put inside of.
If you're using the fact that these brains are infinite, and I think the infinite extent of the brain chooses
a particular
Poincaré.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So in that case, you're not saying it's local, it's some sort of zero.
Right.
So the question goes with that is if we're necessarily using the fact they're infinite in space, Are we also somehow using the fact that they are being, in the simplest cases, they are essentially static in time as well? I mean, are we sampling the zero mode in space locally at each time, or are we sampling the zero mode in CFD space-time? And the latter is the only Lorentzian way to answer, and those two, I get it, maybe a third alternative. So I'm confused about what the story is being carried.
Well, okay, so I think here we use the graphic side to solve for us the strongest of the field theory. This is what we do when we declare that there are higher dimensions in the field theory and so on.
Right.
And in this context, what we learn from that seems to me as a major question, is that the collective coordinate of the D-brain is, you know, well decoupled from the other degrees of field, including light, blue balls, and so on, so not because of energetics, but because of the D-brain miracle of the D-squared. Okay, so we learned that from the gravity side. And so it's a statement in the field theory that the strong coupling, there is this degree of freedom which is well decoupled. And given that, you know, we can set it moving. You're asking whether it just has to sit there. I'm asking about the particular time cord.
Let him speak.
Asking what is the APSDFT description of a large flat D brain for Poincaré match?
That is what you're asking. Yes. Yes. Let him finish. Certainly reduces the weak coupling to that.
This is far away from the D-brain.
If it's varying with P, it's not flat. It has some curvature on the world.
Yeah, I think you can write down some reasonable low energy effective action of small ripples. That's it. Right. Yeah, that's right. Right.
I'm trying to understand what that statement means, though. And my problem here is that if it corresponds to, so certainly there is something on the gravity side, mm-hmm. which is that low energy is called interaction.
Right.
There is some field theory dual.
Right.
My problem with that statement.
Right.
The question is, how much control do we have over what that field theory dual is? And in the case where we're really at a couple of quarters into the moduli space approximation, or something,
right.
when the E-brain is really effectively predefined, flat.
Right.
Okay. I have no problem and no question. But it seems like what we want to do with this is to ask time-dependent questions with some finite time dependence. And if we're going to do that, sort of by Lorentz covariance, we should be able to ask spatially dependent questions with some finite spatial dependence. But then I'm confused about what this bulk boundary map could possibly be that's consistent with the fact that you could embed, that you could choose different Poincaré matches. I don't see what the picture is.
If you'll let me go on, I will actually make that problem a little bit sharper.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
Your solution is not a simple field theory. If you expand about the rolling solution of this set, you find a well-defined approximation scheme controlled by power.
That's also true.
Acceleration. That's what you would look for in your attempt to solve a simple field theory.
Sure.
Okay, and it's a completely well-defined approximation scheme.
My question is, what do you know about what the dual logic field theory looks like?
And we know, so I think we know something about how, I think I know how I would identify it at weak coupling, which is what, roughly what Vijay was saying.
Don't.
Let me go on, and because I think what I'm going to say will get to the heart of it. Yes. Yeah. 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 Yes. I was originally just going to put the word eigenvalue at random points in the talk just to make Joe fly into a rage, but. Steve.
Yeah. Which may be related. There's this old story that the brains are sort of everywhere because of the fluctuations. They fluctuate in the whole space. How do you know?
I think these are, we're looking at the slow motion of large brains. I think they're locked down at infinity. You might worry about the finite orbital folding.
This is why I don't like the word eigenvalue, because as you say, the brains are really fluctuating everywhere.
Right.
And the eigenvalues know this.
Yeah.
And so you have to reduce to some effective loading field theory before you
right.
start trying to talk about the
rule of
this.
Right.
Yeah. You're doing averaging over a long time.
Okay.
So, and then when you average over a long time, the fluctuation becomes smaller.
Okay, so you're coming back, okay.
Or maybe you have to average over a long space. That's what that's.
Yeah, I think that's what we're claiming. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So, Joe, actually, going back to the comment, what is the object for which one's writing down the limit of the effect of action?
It's the effective field theory on the Coulomb branch of the
right. There's a mass scale which.
For the Coulomb branch is parameterized by the scalar
right. Yes.
So those are not. The fields in the Coulomb theory, they're not in general have a simple relation to the field in the.
In the weekly coupled theory,
In the weekly coupled theory, these are eigenvalues.
Yes.
We are in the very strongly coupled theory, and because the symmetry is no longer in it, it did well, the same thing right. that it was in the weekly coupled theory. But all of this is happening in strongly coupled theory, and at some point that's going to be important.
Yes. Eric.
Like, what's the action of pain by going from really flat situ, pure ADS situation, doing some quantum transformation and modeling out?
Yes.
So I don't understand why the time dependence can be, it's just coming from a very standard situation.
Yeah, I don't think until you get to the singularity at this point, there's no sign that this effective action is breaking down. the quibbling at the end is about the map. Not so much quibbling, but the real questions I think that Don and everyone are asking is about the details of the map. But I would say it's certainly some object which, in the weakly coupled theory, would look like eigenvalue dynamics. Okay. So now I just want to go over to the black hole coordinates. At this point, if I look, I have these black hole coordinates here, which a set of coordinates which is not regular at the horizon. The dual gauge theory is on the static cylinder. I'll just write on this side. The transformation from the collapsing cone to the static cylinder is indeed a coordinate transformation followed by a Weyl transformation. I let TP is equal to minus L e to the minus t tilde over L. And then this goes to e to the minus 2 t tilde over L minus dt tilde squared plus d sigma squared. And then I can do an additional Weyl transformation to get rid of this. And since n equals 4 super Yang Mills is a conformal field theory, we should be able to understand how that acts. Yes?
Yeah.
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 You could get corrections, but I think that you're breaking it at a limit of, you're breaking it at scales of order the ADS radius. So I think we can, and then we're not introducing any large curvatures. So I think we can controllably deal with that. Okay. So in this transformation here, I have some the bulk Penrose diagram looks like this. It's just a black hole at finite temperature. The temperature is, I think, roughly 1 over L. Maybe there's a 2 pi there. We expect the, if I study, say, two-point functions of, trace phi to the k, some local nice local operators, those two-point functions will look for all the world thermal. They'll have exponential fall-off at large time. And indeed, one finds that if I take two-point functions on the collapsing cone to two-point functions on the cylinder, because of this exponential transformation, the two-point functions in this become periodic in imaginary time with period L. So the gauge theory on this collapsing cone should be related to thermal gauge theory on the cylinder. Yes? The set of, so we're looking at this black hole is a very particular black hole in a family. And if I reduce, this actually corresponds in some weird way to zero mass in the bulk. As I go to negative mass, I get Reissner-Nordström-like black holes. Below some negative mass threshold, I get a naked singularity, which is probably excised by some sort of enhance-on. Above this temperature, they are just standard black holes of the standard space-like curvature singularity. And that was all mapped out by Amparan back in the 90s, 99. I think the answer is no. 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 I don't think the, it's always large in size. Even at zero temperature, it's got a finite horizon. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. That's exactly right. I don't.
But that's because the boundary of global ADS is just a circle. In AS3, the boundary is just a circle across time.
In one dimension, there's no difference between a circle and a circle.
That's
I mean, computational perspective, if you have a complex, if your boundary can use the, in the complex manifold as a circle, you can do something in the circle that exists, then you can do something in the resting coordinate, then you get the black hole. You can choose something in the complex manifold that exists, then you get the NLO.
Solid.
in general, if you look through Euclidean geometry, you've got a few three on surface and a circle, then there's a whole infinite family of such geometries, which are labeled by elements of the mapping class group of the Riemann surface and a circle. That's an infinite, that mapping class group is infinite, so there should be an infinite number of solutions. Okay. All of them are isometric to the Euclidean version of this geometry. But they would be different contributions to a path integral, you could have those transitions to the sequence. Just like, so that might be the analog. And as you move around in the moduli space of the Riemann surface, you could have subtle transitions between the different. And in fact, those would probably occur precisely when the Riemann surface has automorphism.
Okay. Thanks. Yes.
So if I affect you, you've got this state by mm-hmm. falling out of this group,
mm-hmm.
and you start from a situation that
mm-hmm.
you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow the state that describes this black hole is the state created by the orbifold.
Well, I could have done this without the orbital folding, and what I would get is sort of a Rindler-like geometry in the bulk. And I think there'll still be a finite temperature associated with it. There's also a whole spectrum of these black holes, yes, that's right.
Sending in the
right. Right.
But what I'm asking is whether this, if we do the duplication
right.
would we have to do this in this? I mean, if I think about it more in Hamiltonian framework, would I have to do this in some complicated state that has this amount of entropy?
If I want to talk about this particular geometry, I have to do this in this presumably corresponds to some complicated state at finite energy. You can, right. There's a way you can create that state, I think, which is pretty reasonable, which is exactly that. Well, you could write down some in the static cylinder thing, you could write down some infalling geometry where this thing, where a shell of brains comes in and eventually thermalizes. And then there won't be this other region. Or you can do this, use this description with another asymptotic region, describe the full black hole. One reason we were interested in this particular class of, especially in higher dimensions, was that precisely that there was a way to describe the formation and the a nice channel for the evaporation of the black hole, which you don't always get. The instability is actually, we turned from a bug into a feature. Okay. Now, I mentioned this. Now, it would seem sensible, although it's on rather less. Well, so if I look at this space, this black hole in this space time, I can write down black hole dynamics in this space time. I can write down D-brain dynamics in this space time. This corresponds to D-brains wrapping this compact three manifold and moving in R. And there's a DBI dynamics associated to that, which is just. This is just the volume of the hyperbolic 3 space, dt, r cubed times root r squared over l squared minus 1 minus dt r squared over r squared over l squared minus 1 minus r to the fourth minus l to the fourth over l, like so. This is the four form in a particular gauge, so that it's regular at the horizon. And so this is a perfectly sensible presentation of the dynamics of the probe, describing, and the features are that the dynamics as R goes to L, in these dynamics, T will always go to infinity. It's describing the motion of the D-brains as seen by a Schwarzschild observer. So the D-brains approach the horizon as T goes to infinity. It's also true that the DBI action becomes strongly coupled here. At the horizon. So there's some field theory observable. If one was naive, one might have said this is the strong coupling analog of the eigenvalue dynamics of this field theory at finite temperature, which gives you this action, which is strongly coupled at the horizon, and which seems to reflect the thermal character of the field theory. So if you expand this around r squared equals l squared, you'll find that powers of dt r squared will get the coefficient. If I expand this out in dt r squared, the coefficients of all the higher order terms because of this guy will start to get very large. Well, so in the bulk, of course, I could describe the DBI dynamics. Well, actually, let me talk about that next. I can do just a simple coordinate transformation of that DBI dynamics, which will give me another dynamics which looks identical out at the boundary, but which is regular at the horizon. The horizon is a coordinate singularity, but the fact, but from the point of view of an outside observer, so out at infinity, seeing something fall into the horizon is seeing this thing thermalize. And that's the fact that this thing appears to slow down as time goes to infinity is just reflecting that fact, the thermalization of this class of observables. Yes. Okay.
Supposed to have some
Yes. You can, good. So what I would say is that the analog in the bulk would be talking about a brain in Rindler coordinates.
Okay, well, that could be an example. Yeah. So what is the class of transformations?
Let me go on. I think I'll... Right.
So then what characterizes those field theories that have these kinds of effective actions that have these class of transformations?
Let me go on just for a little bit because I think there's a lot of bulk coordinate transformations you can do. They will correspond to, I think that they correspond to different field theory observables. Those field theory observables might have a fairly ugly relationship between them. And that's, I think, the central question is how to understand that. There's two steps here. In a general, a general field theory won't have a nice bulk dual for starters, right? It won't, unless you have the hierarchy of operator dimensions in large N. Okay. Okay. Let me go on for a bit and go back to this, really. And hold me to that. I'm not trying to push you off. I just think I'm going to go partway to addressing it. Okay. So if you had thought that this was the strong coupling version of the eigenvalue dynamics of this field theory, and yet somehow this looks, in the collapsing cone geometry, this up here also looks somewhat like the strong coupling dynamics of the field theory on the of what the motion on the moduli space, strong coupling version of the eigenvalues, whatever you want to call it, and Vijay's term was eigenvalues, which I quite liked. then you might be a little bit puzzled by this. Because the transformation between these two presentations is, after all, just a conformal transformation. And so if you applied naively the conformal transformation, I would take, in particular, RP corresponds to some mode of some scalar field, and if I was to imagine that these transformed canonically, which of course is a bit dangerous, nonetheless, the action of some canonical dimensionful scalar field will be to transform RP to this R tilde coordinate. And if I do that, I actually get the following DBI action. Square root of 1 minus L fourth over R tilde to the fourth dt R tilde. And also I should say that it's still true that TP is e to the minus L e to the minus T tilde over L plus R tilde over L to the four squared minus 1. You can also study the transformation of the metric ADS metric under these coordinates. And this will give you some Eddington-Finkelstein-like coordinates in the bulk, which look like Schwarzschild out at the horizon, but out at infinity, but nicely go into the horizon and hit the singularity. And the DBI action here, which just comes from this Natch transformation, indeed looks like the DBI action of a brain in the local ADS coordinates out at the boundary. But as you go in, it looks very different from these dynamics. In particular, it looks very different from these dynamics, in particular at R tilde equals L, which is the horizon. This is totally regular.
Like a nice slice.
Sort of. Yeah. So the question is, there's clearly an ambiguity as I go in into the interior as to how to continue the slicing. One set of, if I look at the black hole background, this dynamics seems to reflect the motion read out by this slicing. And as you go to the horizon, t goes to infinity. This dynamics seems to, is there a colored chalk? Oh boy. This dynamic seems to describe a brain falling in these coordinates, and it hits the horizon at finite times and keeps going. Tilde coordinates. I'm just transforming from the. This is just a transformation from the collapsing cone coordinates to the tilde coordinates. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same time slice as the cone,
right? Yeah.
We're just relabeling so that it goes
right.
To infinity.
At the top. Right. So out at the boundary, I should say this metric at the boundary. The metric in TR in T tilde R tilde is like the metric, oh, this is terrible to write with, I'm sorry, is like the metric in TR. So it looks like Schwarzschild out of the boundary. The gauge theory, you would guess that the natural description is in terms of gauge theory on the static cylinder, but there's some other observables which seem to go into the horizon quite nicely that I've just gotten from doing this transformation. So indeed in Schwarzschild, and I would actually claim personally, and this is just me, in any space-time, there is going to be this kind of ambiguity reflecting a choice of the observables that you use to go into the interior. One reason, and I think we had some confusing ways of saying it in the paper, which may have been my fault, but this observable is by no means a nice scaling, by no means corresponds to a nice scaling operator. So I don't actually expect the actual conformal transformation of this R sub P, of the observable corresponding to R sub P, to be axonicely. And so this represents to act very nicely to say that if I do the conformal transformation of this, I'm going to get this dynamics, but there's some other observable which is naturally described by this dynamics. And so there are two different observables, one of which reflects the dynamics of the D-brain as seen by a Schwarzschild observer, one of which reflects the dynamics of the D-brain as seen by an infalling observer, and understanding the relationship between those, I think, is a central question.
One thing I learned when we did this project was, I mean, I was kept wondering, what's special about Schwarzschild coordinates? You know, normally we think about AFCFT, and we sort of say, okay, enter field theory, and you evolve, and things sort of thermalize, and you don't easily get inside the horizon. And in all being said, that's because you're effectively using these Schwarzschild coordinates. And the horizon. So I was thinking, you know, what is special? Why are we picking out Schwarzschild coordinates as opposed to these non-slice coordinates? And I think the reason is, when we describe field theory, we're naturally evolving it with a Hamiltonian, which is sort of not only time translationally in your invariant, time is a point of Hamiltonian, but it's also a invariant of t goes to minus t, with a time reflection symmetry. And all, you know, coordinates which have those properties are the Schwarzschild coordinates. To have nice slice coordinates going through the horizon, you can't preserve this t goes to minus t symmetry. You change your time coordinate to it so that you, breaking
that.
Right.
I would say this would give you a sharp distinction between whatever observable produces this dynamics and whatever observable produces this dynamics. If I have some sort of nice collective coordinates on the moduli space, and I've gotten the dynamics of those in a way that's manifestly time invariant, time reversal invariant, you would get an action like this, I think is essentially what you would be saying. You get Schwarzschild or something very close, you know, some small time reversal invariant perturbation of it, yes.
Naively, this looks something like a local field redefinition on the boundary. If we think of these as local fields on the boundary. But that goes back to this earlier discussion, really there's some averaging.
If I want to do a transformation of this to this, I'm going to do a redefinition of I can write down the transformations between T tilde and R tilde and T and R. And in general, T will be, let me finish. In general, T will be a function of T tilde and R tilde, and R will be a function of T tilde and R tilde. And in particular, from the point of view of the field theory, this is a rather exotic transformation. You're transforming time in a way that depends on the value of the field. In the bulk, of course, that's just a reparameterization. In the boundary, that's a rather complex procedure, and not just in the simplest of local field redefinitions.
So if you take the DBI action and you include the gradient, they appear inside the square root. Do you guys not agree that those perturbations are reliably captured by the protective action with flow of energy?
I think it's not a protective action. I think it actually is protective action for things near the original Poincaré Coulomb branch, which probably does capture.
Right, so this includes, you know,
inhomogeneity. Yeah.
So it's not that you have
to smear
over the entire.
Yeah. What is the scale over which you have to average to get the study description right?
Well, so obviously, from the gravity side, if you started to introduce energies that were huge with the back reaction on the geometry, no longer look like a test object whose
action
is like
the wind valley.
So that's
well,
why not? I mean, what else comes in before that?
Well, there's the fact that if part of the, yeah. I mean, certainly, there's the fact that if you're not interested here at all, you wouldn't know which point for a patch you were describing, very different coordinates you use. So you have to smear over a margin. So if you want to study something that came in depth of the interior, surely you smear over a large enough distance that you can determine which point for a patch you're in is a good enough approximation to avoid this problem.
That could well be. It would. Yeah. That's probably true. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did I answer your question before I go on? That you were asking earlier? You, Vijay, yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. I have the mic.
So suppose for that I took a non-Abelian quantum transaction of a form.
Right.
Trace the square root of 1 minus x dot squared, where x is some un variable. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I guess this thing has a branch where I can sort of peel off an eigenvalue on the x, and I can roll it along.
Right.
Now, so that's a theory that doesn't really have black hole theory, it's just square root of 1 minus x squared.
Right.
Now I choose to rewrite this in a funky way, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to just imagine that one of the eigenvalues is really a coordinate in flat space. And I know the coordinate transformation from flat space to Rittler space. Mm-hmm. So I'll make that coordinate transformation, right?
Okay.
So then I rewrite this this theory, what looks like some interesting.
So we're just doing deep brain dynamics without taking the decoupling limit.
So now I get terms because I made this field redefinition.
Right.
I'll get terms with one minuses and whatnot.
Right.
And now I'll say, well, does that now look like a horizon? Will I get? I'm just trying to understand. So okay, the bottom line that I took away from your paper,
right.
Which, by the way, I like a lot, right? Is that there is a class of transformations that you might make.
Mm-hmm.
Effective action, what did you call them?
Field dependent time reductions.
Which may be the thing that you use to sort of present the dynamics in these interesting ways where you go not go inside.
Right.
Now, all right, fine. But of course, I do not understand what the general class of such transformations is, what I can do them, whether they're legitimate or not. So, all right, so the thing that I might be interested in doing is looking at things, look at motion in flat space, getting them to act as though they're just going behind the horizon. So can I do that with the, for example, the Bornfeld thing?
In the Born-Enfeld, I think you could, at the level of Born-Enfeld, you could certainly do it just by transforming to Rindler coordinates, I would assume. It would be interesting to understand that even from sort of weakly coupled gauge theory point of view. I think that would be really interesting. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
And I raised it that way in part also, but usually in the weakly coupled theory, you wouldn't really expect to have a real black hole.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No.
Okay.
It might be the effective action you get is going to break down horribly near that horizon. I mean, that's a
weak string. Square root of 1 minus x dot squared. I'm allowed.
I think you might need full Born Enfeld, some version of full Born Enfeld, which we I mean, you're just asking about the motion of brains in flat 10-dimensional space and saying, is there some way I can just sort of describe that? And it's from outside. I don't know. I mean, you can measure the mass, obviously, or something, but it's a, look, the two horizons look very similar, and I think that's why there's probably an advantage to trying to think about how to do. I agree. There's an advantage to trying to think about how to do this in flat space for some weakly coupled string theory.
That's true. There's no reason to believe that there's no trouble in cold action. Okay. Also, it's not a comment you can make in response to my comment. Why can't I just make up a black hole that is sort of changing coordinates?
Yeah.
You need to be, so to speak, in a state where you have very large entropies. That only happens in certain kinds of entropies.
Right. But I think it's already an interesting question from the point of view. It's like, even I describe the DBI action, and I look at the DBI action for slow motions of this brain far out from the far from all the other brains. And I will get the DBI action with some natural time, Minkowski time, and I could ask, is there some choice of observables which gives me the DBI action for some particle moving in some non-inertial frame, far from any Rindler horizon? I think that's already an interesting question, yeah. If you ask me. That's a... Eric.
Let me get to general logic. You're interested in knowing what's behind the horizon in some gravity theory.
Yeah.
Are using the fact that there's some dual distinction.
Mm-hmm.
But then, in order to solve it, because we're doing it in a strong limit, we go back to the gravity theory, and by eventually everything in gravity. So what I've seen here is only gravity calculations that I could have done without even knowing about that there was an ABS dual. So the real interesting part
is that's really
that there is a dual, but you're using calculations, which is just
gravity.
So what I have actually learned about singularity, or even the probes, and of course this is just probing the geometry that I already knew that there existed.
I think I can say a few things.
Yes.
I mean, first of all, as Albion started off with, I mean, there was the question in some people's mind whether the duality actually included the region inside the horizon. Some people believe that the dual field theory describes stuff outside the horizon, but in some sense, wasn't really capturing So the first thing you learn is that because this is all covered by the Poincaré patch, is the dual theory clearly is capable of describing physics inside the horizon.
Right.
I still think there are some issues there, which I hope that could be because if you do this orbit fold on the boundary theory, you really would like to know what that means in terms of maybe the operators or whatever the status that you're looking at.
Well, the orbit fold is just on the spatial coordinates, so you're throwing out certain momentum modes. On the boundary, I think that's a completely straightforward thing to do.
I think in the CFT, quite a complicated thing.
It's like putting the CFT in a box. I don't see why that's problematic.
I also think we learned something about how you distinguish between evolution, which keeps outside the horizon, and the evolution which allows it to stay inside.
Right.
That's
important. And that's this field dependent coordinate, time reference, field dependent time reference.
Right.
In the field theory, you have to define what you mean by time, which is a field-dependent thing. Now, agree that that's not completely well-defined because it becomes an operator now, and you can only express it.
So, because that is a national coordinate, what they say, T, and not what it is on the boundary. And there you don't, because you say the time coordinate, that's this.
The only difference between good coordinates, good nice slice coordinates, and Schwarzschild coordinates, is that your good time coordinate is equal to your old time coordinate plus a function of radius. So as long as there's something in your field theory which captures sort of radius, which is like a D-brain position, assuming that's something in your field theory you depend on, and then you can define a new time coordinate, your old time plus some function of this Yang-Mills quantity.
Right.
And that gives you, in the field theory, an analog of going to nice slices in the world.
The other thing, I mean, maybe you should go first.
You said the word thermalization a couple times. I'm not sure what's thermalizing.
You could, for example, send in the brains from infinity into the interior at some energy, and that they would form a black hole. I think in the boundary theory, as these brains come in, you start exciting all the modes of the theory and effectively thermalizing.
While you're in the regime where you have this good Poincaré description, you're not thermalizing.
So there are several, a couple possibilities. One is that you have some class of observables which somehow pierces through the thermal stuff that doesn't thermalize. The other possibility is that the transformation, which is my own heterodox opinion I hold every other Tuesday, is that transformation maps the, if you like, the stretched horizon, the thermal stretched horizon, to something going under the singularity. Some kind of complementarity between the stretched horizon and the strong curvature regime of the singularity. And there was something else I was going. I mean, obviously, one of the questions is now that you have this, to try and find sharp field theory signatures. And at least my goal is that my fantasy, it's similar to fantasies that, for example, Steve Schenker has had about, is that there would be something so sharp that you could understand it even at recoupling, although it's not clearly true. So one thing you could do is look at physical clocks traveling along these probes, corresponding to the ticking of a string oscillator or the ticking of, or the Clusa-Klein oscillation of the brain itself. And you study these clocks in the Schwarzschild coordinates, and you can translate the ticks of those clocks at constant proper time to ticks of the gauge theory clock. And when you do that, everything in the Schwarzschild coordinates, all of the excitations, the clock periods stretch out as you approach the horizon, but they stretch out in a uniform way. They all stretch out in the same way. All of them go as omega goes as e to the minus alpha t times omega naught, where alpha is the same for everything. And this is related to this scalar speed limit and so forth. Now, you can, if you take these nice slice coordinates and do the same thing, you do find that in the nice slice coordinates, omega and all labeled different clocks goes as e to the minus alpha I t tilde omega naught I. I'll put tildes here. I also, because as you go to t equals 0 at the boundary, the t tilde is going to infinity. So in the interior, these time slices are sort of piling up. And the translation is that finite proper time clicks stretch out. But as you go into the singularity, because, for example, I can look at the string oscillator mode, which is ticking at finite proper time, or I could look at a momentum mode on the compact hyperbolic space. And because the compact hyperbolic space is getting small, it's ticking faster and faster, and so I will find, roughly speaking, that this could start to diverge or go to zero, up to a point, because there really are only a finite number of ticks before you hit the singularity. So these are possible sharp signatures of whether your observables are going to the horizon or to the singularity that you could try to look for in the field theory. And that's the kind of thing that Eva, Steve, and Gary and I were beating our heads against for some time. You would hope. Once you do these complicated, for one thing, once you do these complicated transformations, there's no reason that the corresponding observables commute with each other. So you could look for some sort of explicit non-commutative, if you could identify some similar looking gauge theory observables directly, say some weak coupling analogs, you could try to show that they just don't commute.
One of the original pictures of complementarity, right? Because that was a statement that you couldn't describe those things inside and outside the horizon in the same mathematical description.
I think I would really, to see that, I would have to sort of set up those kinds of complementarity thought experiments in the field theory and see whether there was an issue. It might be that even in nice slice, once I set up several probes, there's some non-commutativity that I don't know. I mean, the two observed, yeah.
Look, if you go back to the Poincaré patch in the original
right.
classic problem, would you say there's any problem with writing physics on a complex? I don't think so. There's no reason to say the region, you know, inside is somehow equivalent to the region outside. It's clearly not the case.
Big question. question, or you just raise your hand.
I would like to address some of those points. Questions, those some of those questions. So can I just present?
In the next.
I think I really have a very short thing to say.
Yeah, I'm
mainly conceptual and it goes about trying to do these kind of things. So I'm going to address.
I'm essentially. yes. That was supposed to be a 45-minute discussion, I'll have you know. But I'm just.
I think it's a very nice program because we're going back to questions we've been thinking about, like indeed black hole complementarity. And what I want to discuss today is some things I learned from discussions with other participants here, with Kyriakos Papadimas and also Scheer, who were precisely thinking about similar questions, how to go beyond the horizon. There are many papers have been written about it, and indeed you would like to say, well, how does this possible if you think about black hole complementarity, what is the proper way to do it? So I would like to sort of make some just comments about it, not too technical, but more conceptual. Because if you want to address the black hole information paradox, if we really stay on the outside and think about the conformal field theory and think about unitary evolution, there's not much of a problem there because we believe eventually information will come out. The problem becomes interesting when you try to confront questions like, well, what happens to the guy inside? What happened to the guy outside? How can we make them possible in one description? And I think eventually it will also, of course, teach us about how we think about the singularity. So I'm going to think about this kind of Penrose diagram. And normally we know that the real problems arise when we have two parts of the description where we have fields on the outside, that we have some creation annihilation operators, and on the other side we have creation annihilation operators and we do some Bogoyurov transformations between them. In order to describe what's going on here, you really have to know both type of creation annihilation operators. Of course you might say, well, I can send in a particle from here, but that's not the same as doing a measurement or even knowing what's going on, because it's clear that we have to construct a field out of both.
Yeah, I'm going to go through all of those questions because I think the sharpest question and even the most troubling ones are the ones when you have an eternal black hole. But I'll address this a little bit.
Do you really know that black holes exist?
I understand, but let me make. I'm going to make that a little more precise in my the way of describing it. Because the problem becomes because we believe that there's some way that we should be able to describe this, and it should not sort of be immediately transferred to the outside. But let me make this a little more precise. I'm going to actually define a number of observers in order to do this. I'm going to indeed use ADS-CFT. It's in the wrong place. In ADS-CFT, we can, of course, address these questions quite well. But I think then you have to find both a boundary perspective as well as a bulk kind of picture. Well, it has already been said a number of times that what makes CFT possible is that the CFT has very special properties, namely that the spectrum of the theory has a set of low-lying states, which for large n become independent of n. And then there's some spectrum of states that go up here, which are like the black hole states. And what you usually use in supergravity are operators that we know exists here. Also, just in the large n limit, we can do pure ADS, and then we can think of operators OI, act with them with conformal transformations with some L n's or something like this, and these correspond to all the modes we can find in the bulk of a set of fields. And normally, when we think about ADS-CFT, we use these fields as our probes, because those we send in, and those are the things that really move into the bulk. The states that I have up here, which are really complicated states, are not so easy to create from the boundary. And we have a lot of high degeneracies here and all kinds of transitions that can happen. If you want to create a black hole in ADS, we can do this from the low-lying states by throwing in stuff and then make this state out of it by some Hamiltonian evolution, which makes us believe that we can describe a lot of things in terms of these variables. But let me indeed define some different points of view from different observers, because I think the discussions we've been having can be sometimes confusing if you are not clear about which observer one is talking about. So I want to eventually get to the in-falling observer, or the observer behind here. But first, let me indeed say, what are other type of observers I can have? Sometimes the outside or the boundary observer is treated in different ways. I would like to make one type of observer, which I call omnipotent. It's different, actually, from the super observer that would know behind. What I say, omnipotent really knows everything about the CFT. He can measure everything in terms of the states and everything. And quite often we think about this CFT as living on the boundary. But what's really living on the boundary is we take the perspective of the theory where we probe it with these kind of modes, because those are the modes that we can send in from infinity. If we do the CFT, a CFT has many operators at all scales. So if you do know everything about the CFT, you know every operator, but also at every scale. And since the scale is the radial direction, this observer is not living on the boundary. It's doing its measurements over the entire space. It's really the observer that knows everything. There's also, I would say, the all-knowing observer who knows the Hamiltonian. He doesn't even have to do a measurement. He knows the state and can simply calculate what comes out of it. But if you think about the observer that's omnipotent, he can at least measure it at all time and then think about how this evolves. I think so. It doesn't. I think that's a confusing point of view. And also, then it makes also the discussion of how we want to describe this observer confusing, because we're trying to do it every time from the boundary. We simply have to think about how to embed all these observers in this full CFT. And then the perspective of the boundary observer is where we do it in terms of these variables, because those are the things that we give really the boundary observer. So
we want to map the upper space.
I'm just telling you that boundary should not be used. The omnipotent one has a CFT,
okay,
and that one knows everything. And I think that is equivalent to the full theory in the bulk. And it's just one description, and in terms of that, we know what happens. Of course, we can, as I said, build everything out of the operators like this and build the state here. So if we are a boundary observer, and I call boundary observer the one that uses these fields, then he can know a lot, because he can indeed send in everything, form a black hole, measure eventually everything that comes out. And this is the S matrix point of view. It's very complicated, because we know the black hole forms, it stays there for a long time, eventually evaporates, and we get the thing out. If he knows the S matrix, he can predict things. He can also try to calculate, because it's true that any operator that we put in here can in principle be expressed from the stuff we sent in. So we may say, well, an observer can indeed put a particle in here, but the real confusion starts when, so he can use sort of the S matrix picture. And this is where we form the black hole from ordinary matter or low energy matter, have it stay there for a while, and then evaporate again. But the real questions really come in my mind when we are in a state where we do have a black hole, we try to throw in stuff, and then we would like to understand, why are there these different observers, the ones that go beyond here and the ones here?
And as we just saw, what we usually then do, I mean, microscopically, we would have to solve the full dynamics, but we use ADS-CFT to replace this state by geometry. If we say we are in a black hole state, we write down the geometry. But this is only an effective description that we know can only be used in certain ways. And then we start probing it again with the supergravity calculations. So anything we do in ADS-CFT is usually using these probes on top of a certain background. Of course, what we're really doing is we'll be probing this state. And that's a complicated calculation in some strongly coupled CFT. And this is where ADS-CFT is powerful, because we can use the gravity calculations. But what we're really doing is looking at states on top of this state. And actually, what I'm claiming, the reason why for a black hole, and now I'm going to talk indeed about the outside observer, an inside observer. And if you take both, you would have indeed a super observer that you may not like. That's the observer that indeed say, well, I can do semi-classical physics here and semi-classical physics on the outside, which indeed we argue should not exist. I think the all three exist in a certain way that you can make one Hilbert space where you have the inside and the outside observer, and therefore also the super observer. And the reason I think this is possible, if you think this full picture where you... So now I'm going to take actually the point, explain what these observers are from the perspective of the observer that knows everything. The observer that knows everything would say the following happens indeed. We have states that formed this black hole state. And now we're going to throw in more stuff on top of this. So we're going to look at a situation when we have a state psi, and then we have other operators in the neighborhood. The outside observer can only access these states because those are the gravitons or anything that he can throw in. And anything that comes out at some time. And we know that anything that he constructs from the outside should have to commute with anything that's on the inside. I'm claiming in order to know, and this is actually the main point I want to make, to know what's going on here, there's no way of avoiding of disentangling what's going on here. The reason why there is some asymptotic region, a new asymptotic region in a black hole, is because there are many low-lying states, low-lying perturbations on top of this geometry. So the perspective of the microscopic quantum field theory on the different observers that I have here is that these operators are the ones that the outside observers sees. But we know when we evolve this state with the Hamiltonian, there's always operator mixing. We cannot disentangle the states that we have here with slight excitations that happen on top of this state. So, so how should I say this? The state of the black hole is some complicated state on which we can act with our operators. But this is something else. I have to make this. Yes, so what I need to understand here is that I have modes from inside for the outside observers, which you send in and then you reflect back. But the modes that are on the inside are really different type of modes, and you have to have a Fock space that describes both the outside curation annihilation operators as well as the inside. And in order to get this bigger Fock space where you have to sort of disentangle these two, the outside observers can only see probes which we put on from a boundary construct out of those states. In order to describe the infalling observer, we really have to go inside what's going on these levels, and that's a very complicated evolution. You have to know what the excitations are of these states. So now let me think indeed about what would be the state. So we take this state in the full theory, and now we want to describe it in terms of the excitations on top of this geometry. And we know what that does. Actually, this is what Hawking taught us. I mean, we have some set of states which are excitations in A and B of some thermal type of states, where we have states on the side 2 and 1, and this is our state. But what I'm claiming that these excitations are describing are excitations both constructed out of these type of operators, as well as excitations that go on here. They're light excitations. On the geometry that you look at, what we do in supergravity, we're only looking at the smallest excitations, the hydrodynamic modes. And when you have this big state in here, because of its high degeneracy, you're adding many more light excitations. So the region behind the horizon is really what has to be happening in those variables. So when we define our operators here by simply using these boundary states, using our equations of motion, and say we go beyond the horizon, and thereby saying we've defined a state here, I don't think we've done so. I think we really have to understand what is going on the excitation of these states in order to know what's really happening on the boundary. So all of the papers that I've seen on trying to construct operators behind the horizon is doing the thing that I just said. You replace the state by the geometry, you solve your equations of motion, and you declare that what you have constructed there is an operator behind the horizon. But you have missed the essence of it, which are the excitations of these states. The essence of what the states are. You really, from the boundary perspective, the operators that you construct should change the state of the black hole, because you're acting with operators that make use of the degeneracy of these states. Sorry? Yes.
Say they are looking at a state in the CFD that corresponds to a black hole, something like psi, and they're looking at excitation on top of that.
Okay, so maybe I should say then, so if you take your fields in the full bulk, we can define our operators B and B Dekker in the usual way, but then indeed those operators should be thought of as generating transitions in those states, which I claim is not the same as adding these normal operators, which we normally do on the boundary, because I think this is an operation in the full CFT, which is not an operation on the boundary.
But you agree that those two set of operators mix in time?
That's correct. And so that what I'm claiming is that there is an enlargement of this space that includes the perturbations here. But it doesn't mean that I've defined the operators which I have here in terms of the operators that I normally construct on the boundary. And this is the usual expression that we give. I mean, we make some Green's function from here to here, and then...
So you're saying you don't know those steps that you're
regressing? Sorry? Sorry. Now, okay, here we go to the question of Steve. If I think about propagation from here to here and throw in my mode and then simply say I know how to solve the field equations and put it in there, but somehow you put in the fact that you know that anything that in here can be constructed out of the operators on the boundary. I'm thinking about this situation where you really force yourself to think about a Hilbert space that commutes with the Hilbert space that is inside. This Hilbert space, which is defined at a later time, and this is why I like the eternal situation. If I really think about a black hole that was formed and stays there for a very long time, and I don't allow myself to really go back a long, long, long time to throw in everything that I know about, but simply think about a finite period of time on the boundary, then I have this part of the space, which is my causal diamond, with which I can communicate. And anything that's beyond that would not be part of the operators that I would be able to construct on the boundary. So there is some way, and this is actually this
complementarity issue, that if you allow yourself these probes on the boundary, you would never be able to say what's going on there. So you have to allow probes that know about this state. So, and I think what happens when the infalling observer knows a lot more, he knows how to change the state of the black hole. The outside observer simply throws in this kind of stuff. Of course, it interacts with it. But in order to have the infalling observer, you have to allow more operators. So let me give this a name. This is region one. But it's almost a copy of the same set of states, which is constructed out of this, the same set of states, but then in region two. So it's, I think the outside observer can measure those states. Anything you do on the outside, you create a particle, you throw in stuff. This particle that you throw in from here is only changing this part of the state. And in order to change this part of the state, you have to do something else. And this is exciting, doing things inside the black hole. Go ahead. Yes.
But you can break everything in terms of let's say the indoor and the outdoor supergravity field.
So this observer you're asking about.
Yeah, you can have two particles, high energy particles, in the black.
Yes.
And then it evaporates.
Yes.
If you have outdoor particles, you measure it and then
yes. I understand.
So there, you seem to have a complete description of the one thing from the outside.
Yes. Oh, but that's precisely why I said this. Precisely the comments I made here. So I'm thinking here about a. No, but the real confusion, and I think really this is where you start addressing the issue. If you take this, I mean, because part of the whole discussion is about nice slices, for instance. If I think about a nice slice in a black hole, whatever way you draw it, I mean, there's some slice in here that we've been drawing. And this is where the confusion stops. Because here we would say we have part of this Hilbert space here, and we have the part of the Hilbert space there. It's true that if you think about all of the way that the past happened, you can throw things in. But this description is here you are in a state of the Hilbert, well, if I think about the evolution from the boundary, if we think about where we are at this time, we have a state, but a very complicated state that describes the black hole, and we may try to construct things that we have been, well, throwing in, and they're moving on the background of that black hole. What I like to understand, can I indeed in that context identify in my Hilbert space the states that are on the outside of the horizon and the states that are on the inside of the horizon? I'm saying yes, because I can still do the same thing as I always do in ADS-CFT and throw in these kind of states. But in order to describe what's going on behind the horizon, I have to allow more excitations than just these, which are the ones that are excitations on the state that I already have. I'm distinguishing B's and the A's, that's correct. No, that's just a name, because I could have... what I'm saying is that even the infalling geometry, I can distinguish... No. Now let me do. Now let me actually. Maybe I should draw that clearer then. I'm thinking of the A's that in this geometry I can construct there semi-classically. Of course, they are things that have to be sent in after a certain amount of time. But I also think there must be things there because without. I mean, if you're telling me that everything is here was on the outside anyway, then indeed we would not have had a problem to begin with. The problem comes because we think there must be operators here that commute with most everything that we would have
naively gotten here. So what I'm telling you is this problem, how that maps onto something that we can see microscopically happening in the description of this theory. So I'm thinking about a moment of time here when we do have a state describing a black hole. We do have stuff that we can throw in that we can also see coming out, and those are the states that I call A and A dagger, and they really have to do with thinking about this geometry in some approximate static patch or static Schwarzschild coordinates. It's the mode that go on the inside that I've not been able to identify otherwise than as excitations on top of the states. You're using the fact that there are all kinds of degeneracies in this big state in order to define this Hilbert space. So I don't think there's a definition microscopically of what's going on beyond the horizon without addressing the issue, what are the microstates of the black holes or how I go in between them. Semi-classically, you can calculate it using the supergravity. But then you go back into this picture, and I don't think your conclusions will be anything different than what we would have normally gotten from supergravity calculations. I think in order to address the microscopics, I think you have to address the issue that there is this big state there on which you can have all kinds of excitations. Yes?
Real issue is that any operator where you find
I agree with this, but I think for large n, what I'm claiming indeed, that if you think about the Hilbert space as constructed out of these states, there is an enormous sector that you have ignored, which would be normally identified with what we put behind the horizon. And so anything that we do with the black hole states is not visible from the outside, and those excitations are really the excitations that we think about what's going on here. If you take the full perspective, of course, there's just the unitary evolution, and we can get everything out eventually. But there is a moment when we have excitations that we normally would not see from the outside. So this disconnection between what's inside and outside is really, I think, what you construct from the outside by sending in your normal modes, and what you would think about as excitations on this state, which is a very different type of operator. No, it's of order e to the minus s in the sense that you have to wait long enough. But what I'm telling you is that there is microscopically a way in which, if we have to stay there for a very long time, in which we can try to distinguish what's inside the black hole and what's outside the black hole by saying whatever the stuff is that we can probe the geometry with, which would be our normal supergravity fields on the outside. We should distinguish this from the things that are excitations on top of the states, which are of the same low energy nature, because they're low energy excitations I can put on this, call them the hydrodynamics mode. There's some ways that we probe the black hole. There are ways when I throw in this stuff that it will change the state here. And this is indeed corresponding to anything that I would throw in. And there are ways that it can come out again dynamically. But in very good approximations, those two sectors are decoupled, and this is why they commute. So I think the fact that we have to use this state in order to understand what is the reason for decoupling of those two sectors. And yeah, this is the main comment I would like to make. And this is, I think, where you might still talk about a super observer. The super observer would indeed see the excitations here. He would see the excitations on top of that. And then both regions exist semi-classically. The real observer who's omnipotent doesn't even care about what's inside or outside the horizon, and he can see the whole thing happening. So the statement that you cannot describe things inside and outside should be sort of more made more.
Just a
more subtle statement.
You are joining speed and proposing the opposite of the fast scrambling picture with the Dixie Climb between a ship on the south and a detailed Dixie Climb goals as long as you can possibly.
No. No, well, no, but, no, no, but, because I think.
Fast scrambling is one extreme. But just to clarify what's being said, you're saying that fast scrambling is not the right description. Fast scrambling can claim that all these days you've mixed up on roughly the interval lines.
Oh, you mean that how much time is it needed before you sort of? I mean, what I really think that there is a very sharp distinction between what we can call outside, if very large n. We have things that we have outside and things that we have inside. And so there must be a very sharp, quick way in which these states that I constructed sort of from this. I mean, of course, you can say the Hamiltonian evolution already starts mixing these states, but there must be some way in which I can make a quite a sharp separation between two Hilbert spaces.